Good afternoon. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have, you know, on our afternoon session, two oral arguments scheduled. We will take a recess after the first one, though, for about 10 minutes, because we'll have a change of panel. And now we will go ahead and get started with the first case, if the lawyers are ready. So I'll ask the clerk to call it.
The court will now call William J. Kelly, LLI, Paris, and Technology International, LLC, versus Philip Kenton and Dave and Don Sarek. May it please the court, Ms. James Webb will argue for the appellate. Ms. Andrea Lucera-Noretta will argue for the appellate.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Weber, would you like to begin?
May it please the court. We're here before the court. I represent the appellants, and we're here asking the court to reverse the judgment, the summary judgment that brought us here, for three procedural reasons. First, because the trial court should never have gotten to summary judgment and instead should have taken up the issue of whether these claims belonged in arbitration instead. Second, because the broad brush claims preclusive requests for admissions, the deemed admissions, are an inappropriate basis for summary judgment. And third, the procedural timing of the summary judgment hearing under on this record rendered the notice unfair and unclear and didn't satisfy the necessary due process standards that the Supreme Court has required under where you have a claims preclusive discovery issue here. And I'd like to turn first to the arbitration issue because I think it presents the most substantial policy issue for this court.
Okay.
There's no way to overstate how significant and strong the Texas state and the federal public policy is in favor of arbitration, enforcing arbitration agreements. There's the phrases that are used in the cases over time arbitration should be enforced unless it can be said with positive assurance that the parties didn't agree to it. Procedurally, arbitration provisions are subject to, they're supposed to be taken up and addressed first in a case, and then if a party moves for arbitration and it is denied, the motion to compel is denied, the law under both state and federal constructs allows immediate appellate review, either by an interlocutory appeal or by a mandamus, depending on whether you're state or federal. And meanwhile, if the arbitration goes up in the interlocutory appellate review, then everything else gets stayed below. And all of those things fit together as a, we really mean it. Arbitration really is a significant and important and strongly favored policy. And what we had here was a trial court whose procedures not only did not advance that policy, but undermined it by refusing, despite numerous requests, even to set the motion to compel arbitration for hearing. Now, it is true that the requests were in non-traditional ways. There wasn't a pleading signed by an attorney saying, please set my motion to compel arbitration for hearing. But there is nothing in the rules of civil procedure or the Tarrant County local rules that says a letter by a pro se litigant is ineffective to invoke the open courts of this state.
Why don't we go there first? I only found one letter dated October the 20th, 2011, where you asked for a hearing. I hear all kinds of things. I want a ruling, and here's why. I found one on October 20th asking for a hearing, both in the prayer and in the first paragraph.
And the title says motion for expedited telephonic hearing. Is that what you're talking about?
Right.
Your Honor, I have two responses to that. One is the law does not demand magic words.
Okay.
If I say to a court, I've filed a motion, please rule on my motion, then the response of the court coordinator ought to be, okay, I can set your hearing on Wednesday, August the 12th at 11 a.m. A request for a ruling under any circumstances shouldn't be considered an ineffective method to request a hearing, and that is especially true where you have arbitration at stake. I'm sorry, Mr. Kelly, You didn't say the magic word, and so I'm going to ignore this substantial public policy issue until you've said the magic word in the magic way. That is inappropriate. And second, they did ask for it through that. Even if you're going to hold them to the most hyper-technical, the piece of paper has to be there, the staple has to be diagonal and not horizontal, they did that. They complied with that. And then also, if you look in the record here, there was no formalistic procedure required or demanded of the plaintiffs when they got their summary judgment hearing set. That really goes to the fundamental unfairness here. Is it wasn't that the trial court consistently and strictly and one could say appropriately enforced written rules and procedures that were clear for everybody, enforced them the same for everybody. That is not what happened here. First, no procedure or administrative practice is written anywhere. It is still to this day, not in any brief, not in the trial transcript where the trial court said, we bent over backwards. Nobody has ever articulated any procedure or hoop that my clients failed to jump through. But then you also look in the record, and Clerk's Record, Volume 1, pages 253 and 254. There sequentially, there are two letters, one dated September 12, one dated September 13, both written by plaintiff's counsel. One is his filing letter sending in the motion for summary judgment. And then, but it has some handwritten notes by the court coordinator, which you can see from our Appendix 3 was her practice. Whenever she had phone conversations with a party or a litigant or counsel, she would make notes on the letters in the file of conversations and dates and such. And there's a note by her that says 30 minutes set 11-11-11, which was the summary judgment date, 11 a.m., and then initialed and dated. And then the next day, there's a letter by plaintiff's counsel addressed to my client saying, a hearing on plaintiff's traditional motion for summary judgment has been set for November 11, 2011 at 11 a.m. So what happened is that the attorney representing the plaintiffs picked up the phone and called the court coordinator, said, I've got this motion on file. When can I have a hearing? She said, sure, you can have it on November 11th. And then he sent a notice to the other side. And why couldn't that have happened to my clients? Why didn't that happen? It's inappropriate that the court treated two sets of litigants differently, but it is especially inappropriate where doing so undermined the important public policy of arbitration. All the court had to do was on one of those phone calls say, okay, Mr. Kelly, you can have a hearing on thus and so a date at thus and so a time, send opposing counsel a letter and let them know that date. And that would be done.
At the hearing, I think it was on the motion for new trial, the court coordinator maybe testified that she told them what to do, but they never did it. What did she say what she told them to do?
No, Your Honor. Actually, the court coordinator did not speak. The court did.
The court spoke. Okay.
The court spoke and said, I talked to my court coordinator about this, and we kept telling Mr. Kelly what to do, and we bent over backwards, and we tell him what to do, and he didn't do it. And nowhere is there anything of what he failed to do. Nowhere is it identified what the magic act was that was required. And in fact, he did many, many acts. He sent lots of written correspondence signed saying, please, here's this arbitration thing. Please take this up and rule on it. He ultimately used the magic word. He provided a certificate of conference saying, I've spoken with opposing counsel. They oppose this. The court needs to decide it. He talked to the court coordinator on the phone. There isn't any reason why talking to the court coordinator on the phone, the same thing couldn't have happened as when the court set the summary judgment for hearing based on talking to the court coordinator on the phone. There's nothing in the rules of civil procedure. There's nothing in the Tarrant County local rules that my clients failed to comply with. No hoop that they failed to jump through.
I think that the certificate of conference, also, if you want to call it that, also occurred on September 19th. For the first time. It's in the second paragraph on page 2.
And why didn't it happen thereafter? Why wasn't it set for hearing thereafter? Because this continued to happen. There was never a moment where the court took up the arbitration issue. Now, the Tarrant County local rules do distinguish between dispositive motions, like a summary judgment, and other sorts of motions in one procedural way, and that is that you don't have to have a certificate of conference for a summary judgment motion, because sensibly, we assume that the other party's going to oppose that. But other than that, there is no distinction between those, so there should be no distinction in how you can get a hearing set, and yet there was here. And again, it's arbitration. Arbitration is concerned. Courts are supposed to bend over backwards to enforce arbitration, and that didn't happen here. So the court never should have reached at all the summary judgment motion, should have taken up the arbitration, motion to compel arbitration in advance and decided it on the merits. Now, my preferred remedy from this court would be a reverse and render an order to the trial court to send this to arbitration. I think realistically, the most sensible remedy would be a reverse and remand, because since this was never set for hearing, there was never a full record developed below on the merits of the motion to compel arbitration. And so I believe that the most appropriate remedy for this court would be to send it back for the trial court to decide on the merits the motion to compel arbitration and decide whether or not these claims properly belong there. Now, if the motion to compel arbitration is meritorious and these claims do belong in arbitration, then litigation in Tarrant County is absolutely inappropriate, because the arbitration provision says it belongs in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. So this really is wholly dispositive of this particular litigation.
Well, let's talk about something else that's wholly dispositive according to your distinguished opposing counsel. Let me read you five sentences from her brief. Appellant's motion was void ab initio in the absence of a signature of a licensed attorney or eligible pro se party. Appellant's only complaint on appeal relates to the part of the motion which sought to compel arbitration. By the plain language of appellant's motion, the only appellant for whom arbitration was sought to be compelled was Technotree. Neither Kelly nor Kiros pleaded for the trial court to compel arbitration against them. In other words, Technotree did not have a lawyer sign its motion, hence it's not before the court, because as we all know, a pro se person cannot represent a company. So how do you respond to that?
My response to that is discussed in full starting at page 3 of my reply brief, but it comes down to this. First of all, it is not any defect is in form only and does not render the arbitration motion void ab initio. There is no authority cited for that proposition that makes it void ab initio, that makes it a nullity that the trial court can blow off. Those are defects in form only that parties are entitled to correct. Second, even an entity cannot represent itself pro se, but that is also a defect in form and doesn't render it a nullity. So if the court had taken up the motion to compel arbitration, then at the hearing, I's would have had to be dotted and T's would have had to be crossed, but the defect of an entity being pro se was not sufficient for the trial court to blow it off such that it's not appropriately before you today. Third, although the motion, the recital at the beginning of it says this is on behalf of Technotree, which was the entity for whom the operating agreement exists and it has the arbitration provision in it, the discussion, the body of that pleading says all claims, not just as to Technotree, as to the individual defendants as well, and all the defendants ask that all of the litigation be stayed so that all claims can go. And finally, all of the series of letters of Mr. Kelly, all of those things, I think realistically, are supplementation to the motion to compel arbitration. Those are signed by Mr. Kelly, who is absolutely entitled to represent himself pro se. And I say that those are supplementation of the motion to compel arbitration because if you look at the body of each of them, there's discussion of, and this is what the arbitration clause says, and these are what the claims are, and these how they fit in. Those are all by way of discussion of the merits, fleshing out of the merits of the request for arbitration. So for all of those reasons, the trial court was not was not authorized, it was not appropriate for the trial court to treat it as a nullity. And it was there. It may have had procedural defects, but they did not render it void, and it's appropriately before you today.
So was there any special exception or
nothing.
Objection based on?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
No, like I said, it never got, there was never a record. Nothing happened to it. It got filed. All the letters got sent. Come on, court. Let's do this. It's supposed to be an arbitration, and then summary judgment happened. So the merits, the body, the fullness of time of the arbitration motion never happened in the trial court below. And then real quickly before my opening time ends, the issue of the summary judgment being resting wholly on the deemed admissions is inappropriate, not just because of the bait and switch of the timing, which was very goofy, made a very confusing and unclear procedural circumstance of, were you going to have a hearing on that date at all? Second, did that trigger a response date beyond which my clients had to file a response and move to withdraw the deemed admissions? But the Texas Supreme Court in the Marino case just last year and in the Wheeler versus Green case, which Marino relies on a lot, condemned roundly the use of case dispositive requests for admission like we're at issue here, where a party seeks its wholly claims and defense preclusive, and said that if a summary judgment is going to rest on that kind of deemed admission, you have to jump through the bad faith and flagrant disregard hoops that you would have to for death penalty sanctions. They cite the Trans-American case, and there is nothing, and the Supreme Court said that is part of the plaintiff's summary judgment burden. If you're going to get summary judgment on that kind of deemed admissions, you've got to prove that you've satisfied the Trans-American burden.
I have a question for you. Procedurally, if the arbitration issue has to go back for consideration by the trial court, do we even have to reach the merits of the summary judgment, or is that just reversed as a procedural matter?
Reversed as a procedural matter, Your Honor. If you say the trial court should have taken up arbitration earlier on threshold, vacate the summary judgment on the procedural grounds, and you don't need to worry with the request for admissions at all. Just you can limit your holding to that.
Well, if we send it back and the trial court determines that arbitration was not an issue, then we're back here to rule on the merits, and then that might or might not reflect whether or not the summary judgment was appropriate.
Well, Your Honor, if we go back to the trial court and she says deny motion to compel arbitration, then we're back in front of you not on the summary judgment merits, but we're back in front of you on the arbitration.
Back in front of us on the arbitration, and
yes,
depending on how we rule on the arbitration, might or might not reflect the outcome of the summary judgment hearing. Okay, I got you.
Like I said at the earlier, Your Honor, I would be tickled pink if you would order the trial court to send us to arbitration. But I think, frankly, candidly, the record needs to be developed a little more, and I'll bet you a dollar that my opposing counsel would agree with me on that procedural point.
Thank you, counsel. Ready? Ms. Borissa?
That's right. May it please the court. I'm Andrea Borissa. I have the privilege of representing Philip Henson and Don Surratt in this matter. And both sides have briefed a considerable number of issues, and it's clear you're very familiar with them. And I think for the purposes of today, this case really comes down to just one issue, and that's whether the appellants are entitled to any relief at all on appeal when they did absolutely nothing in compliance with Texas procedural rules in the trial court. The appellants have gone to great lengths to portray themselves as victims of the system. They were trying to cross the T's and dot the I's. They were trying to do the right thing, get their motions set. But the record does not reflect that. What the record shows.
What did they not do procedurally? What was their procedural flaw?
I have the same question. Exactly what did they fail to do?
I've got a list here of all of the rules that were completely disregarded by the appellants in the trial court, and we'll just go through them chronologically if that's all right with the court. The first being Rule 198, which is request for admission. There's a deadline for responding. The appellants did not respond to the request for admission. Rule 120A states that if you have a special appearance on file, you can participate in discovery, even if you have that special appearance and you have not waived that special appearance. The appellants didn't read Rule 120A, or they would have known. They could answer discovery without waiving their special appearance. They failed to object to any perceived refusal by the trial court to rule on the motion to compel arbitration, which is a requirement for preserving error under Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 33.1.
But how could they object when there wasn't a ruling?
Well, Rule 33.1 requires a party who has requested a ruling and been denied to then object to the court's refusal to rule. There must be an objection to the perceived refusal. We don't agree that there was a refusal to rule. And I think it'll help if we back up to how we got to this point. The appellants filed a special appearance, or what they called it, a special appearance. The record shows that it was not rule compliant and that they had waived the special appearance. The appellants attempted then to litigate the case by betting on both sides of the coin. On the one hand, they have a special appearance. Therefore, they don't intend to answer discovery. But on the other hand, we don't really care about our special appearance if you're willing to grant our motion to compel arbitration. We would submit that when you look at the record as a whole, it reflects the fact that the appellants didn't want a hearing on the motion to compel arbitration, because then they would have had to answer our discovery. So instead, they wanted a ruling. They wanted the court to send the case to arbitration. And it wasn't until they realized, okay, we've communicated with the trial court, they've told us we have to have a hearing, fine, we'll have a hearing. So there was no intent on the part of the appellants to go through and participate in the litigation. They were waiving their special appearance as a sword and a shield to prevent them having to participate in any of the motions that the appellees filed.
But weren't
filed.
They really just waiting to see if they were going to go to arbitration? I mean, how can you distinguish between waiting on the special appearance or waiting on getting to go to arbitration?
I would submit that they were hoping for either one, and they were trying to bet both sides. They were trying to say, we have a special appearance, therefore we don't want to participate in the case, but we're willing to set aside our special appearance if you're going to send us to arbitration. So they're trying to have it both ways. And that type of gamesmanship is what ultimately led them into a summary judgment.
So you said a minute ago they failed to object to the trial court's refusal to rule.
That's
on
correct.
Their motion to compel arbitration. They didn't get a ruling. Why wouldn't the granting of the summary judgment be an implicit denial of the motion to compel arbitration?
Well, Your Honor, the summary judgment hearing actually had a very significant legal effect, and that is that if you fail to respond to a motion for summary judgment, you have waived any complaints that you did not raise in your motion, in your response to the motion.
Oh, well, I don't think that's necessarily true. Under Clear Creek and McConnell cases, the Supreme Court has said you can always raise legal sufficiency of the motion for summary judgment for the first time on appeal.
My apologies, Your Honor. You're absolutely correct. I meant to limit that statement to complaints regarding necessity of compelling arbitration.
Okay.
And to that, I would point the court toward the case of Divine v. American Express Centurion Bank, in which we have an exactly analogous situation. John Divine said, I got summary judgment entered against me, but I had a motion to compel arbitration, and I had filed it, and the trial court refused to rule. And the Court of Appeals said, well, that's unfortunate for you because you didn't raise it in a response to a motion for summary judgment. Therefore, you have waived that complaint. So regardless of the efforts they might have made to obtain a ruling, they did not raise it in a written response to the motion for summary judgment. So it has been waived. That argument cannot be a basis for reversing summary judgment as stated by the court in the Divine case.
So what should they have done? What should they have done to get a hearing set for their motion to compel arbitration?
Your Honor, Ms. Weber and I are in a unique situation in that neither of us were trial counsel at the time that this motion was entered, so I think both of us are limited in our knowledge to what's in the record. And so I would refer the court to the record wherein, at the hearing on the motion for new trial, Judge Wilkinson said, I frankly wanted you to know, as Mr. Kelly's counsel, that our court has been over backwards to make sure that he had a clear understanding of how to have his day in court, and for whatever reason, he never chose to appear or participate in the process. Those were the words of the trial court judge. Now, there's no evidence contradicting that statement anywhere in the record.
But the trial court has to follow the Texas Rules of Civil Procedure and the local rules. So the local rules that I perceived we were talking about were you didn't get a certificate of conference and you didn't call the court or send in a fiat and ask for a hearing and get it set and notify opposing counsel. But on the September 19th letter, on the second page, there appears to be what could be construed as certificate of conference. I call plaintiff's counsel, so forth, and report back to the court that we couldn't reach an agreement. All right. And then on the October 20th file, or the file date of October 20th, that letter, the motion asks for a hearing. So if you've asked for a hearing and you've gotten a certificate of conference, those could only be the two local or rules of civil procedure rules that weren't followed that I know of.
Your Honor, your understanding is the same as mine. It's not clear what Mr. Kelly or Mr. Kiros failed to do, but I would submit that those are the two individuals who would have the most information about what it is that they were told they failed to do. My clients were not parties to any of the communications that the court clerk had with Mr. Kelly, so we honestly don't have any firsthand information about what was told to Mr. Kelly about how he needed to set his motion for hearing. But in the motion for new trial, Mr. Kelly could have submitted an affidavit. In fact, he did submit an affidavit. And in that affidavit, he never said, the trial court ignored my phone calls, the trial court declined to answer my phone calls, the trial court told me I had to do X, Y, and Z to set my motion for hearing, and I can't do X, Y, and Z. That would have been the perfect opportunity for Mr. Kelly to explain how it was that he was denied this opportunity to have his motion heard. There's no evidence of that in the record.
Well,
there
is evidence that the trial court ignored his letters.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit that the letters requested a ruling and not a hearing, and that distinction is important because on one foot they're standing on their special appearance, and on the other foot they're standing on their motion to compel arbitration. So the idea that that's a distinction without a difference doesn't hold water when you look at how they were using their pleadings to try to not have to engage in litigation, not have to deign to participate in the process, unless, of course, you're going to grant the motion that we want you to grant, in which case we don't really care about our special appearance. And it was that type of trying to have it both ways that ultimately led them to this situation.
But, well, I mean, I'm hearing you that there's a distinction between I want a ruling and I want a hearing. I think that's pretty obvious. But they did request a hearing, and they did get a certificate of conference. And as far as I'm concerned, under the local and Texas Rule of Civil Procedure, they were at that point, seems to me, entitled to have a hearing set.
Your Honor, for argument's sake, if that were true, their opportunity to make that point would have been in their response to the summary judgment motion. Otherwise, under Devine, that objection has been waived. You cannot reverse summary judgment on an argument that you did not make in response to the summary judgment
motion.
But
there was no ground in the motion for summary judgment based upon their entitlement or anything having to do with arbitration. So why would they have to respond? Well, on the basis of being entitled to arbitration.
Your Honor, in the Devine case, the court discusses the fact that if you believe that the trial court lacks the authority to hear the case on the basis of arbitration or similar provisions, your opportunity to raise that argument is in your response. And that obligation exists regardless of whether the movement has made the argument that somehow they're... In other words, the movement for summary judgment is not required to negate your motion to compel arbitration in order to establish their prima facie case.
What you're saying, I think, is that in a response to a motion for summary judgment, you need to set out all the reasons why the other side is not entitled to have his motion granted. And you're saying, and in this case, a reason that the other side was not entitled to have their motion granted was that this case should have been sent to arbitration, in which case we wouldn't be hearing the motion.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that brings us to the summary judgment and what the appellants have referred to as a bait and switch. I would like to draw the court's attention to the record at page 379. This is a plaintiff's motion for trial continuance. Paragraph 2 says, on September 12, 2011, plaintiffs filed their motion for traditional summary judgment, which, if granted, would grant plaintiffs all the relief they are requesting. Due to the court's docket, the motion for summary judgment could not be heard before the date set for the trial of this matter on November 7th. And then it goes on to say that the motion has been set for Friday, November 11th, 2011. That was the basis for the plaintiff's request for a trial continuance. On the record at page 382, we have, if you look at the footer, an order granting the plaintiff's motion for trial continuance. In other words, the trial court saw the motion, they had the attached order. They entered the attached order, continuing the trial date, specifically so the summary judgment hearing could be accommodated. A summary judgment motion was filed on September 12th. Trial was set for November 7th. There were no summary judgment hearing dates available between those dates. So because of the court's docket, the appellees had no choice but to set their motion for summary judgment on November 11th. And as a result of that, they moved to continue the trial date so that they can have their summary judgment heard on the court's summary judgment docket. That was communicated to the appellants. There's no evidence in the record that they were confused about that. There's no affidavit in the record that the appellants didn't know about the summary judgment hearing. They signed an affidavit saying, we didn't participate in discovery because we thought we could stand on our special appearance. Nothing in that affidavit states, we didn't know about the hearing. We were confused about the hearing. We would have responded if we'd known about the hearing. We don't even know what they would have done had they known about the hearing. Would they have filed a response? Would they have filed an objection? Would they have appeared and objected to the court's refusal to rule? The record is silent on how the notice was inadequate or what they would have done differently. There's no evidence in the record of that. The appellants have the firsthand knowledge of, were they confused, were they not confused? Well, they didn't submit any affidavits telling the trial court we were confused. That's an argument that counsel has made without any supporting evidence in the record. There's no evidence that they were confused. There's no evidence that they read what I just read to you and thought, it sounds like they are rescheduling. That is not a reasonable interpretation of that paragraph. Paragraph expressly states that the summary judgment motion couldn't be set till after the trial date, and then it goes on to say we'd like to move the trial date so that we can have our motion heard. So that's what's in the record. There's nothing tricky about, there's no alternate reading of that that would justify a determination that these defendants were confused about when the hearing would be held, especially when they themselves did not submit any evidence or affidavits that they were. That takes us to the deemed admissions. Marino v. King did talk about deemed admissions that go to the merits of a case, and they did discourage counsel from sending requests for admissions about matters that they know to be disputed. Nowhere in the record have the appellants laid out where exactly the appellees were wrong in their assertion of the facts of the case. So without having any understanding of what the appellants believed the case to be about, all of the issues were susceptible to a request for admission. And in addition, the Marino v. King case is actually inapplicable here because in Marino, we had a plaintiff who raised her objection before judgment was entered. Now, the appellant's counsel has argued that, well, since they didn't know when the summary judgment response was due, they didn't know when they needed to object to the deemed admissions. That argument's a red herring. Rule 198 says if you don't answer your discovery, those admissions are deemed against you. Your obligation to seek to withdraw them begins then. It's not tied to a summary judgment motion. It doesn't matter if there's no summary judgment hearing. It doesn't matter if there's no summary judgment motion. Those deemed admissions are on the books. They never, for 59 days between notice of the deemed admissions by summary judgment motion, which spelled out, you didn't answer these deemed admissions, they are conclusively established against you. There is no way that a reasonable person would read that and not have a reaction to that and think, I need to do something about that. For 59 days, the appellants did not do anything about that. It doesn't matter if they raised it in a response to a summary judgment. They could have raised it in any pleading they wanted to. But they filed no pleadings challenging the deemed admissions prior to the entry of judgment. They waited until after judgment was rendered, and then they decided to take the case seriously. Because they did not avail themselves of the procedural options available to them in the trial court, we would submit that they have not earned any relief from this court on appeal. Unless you have any questions, conclude. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Weber?
Please, the court. I just want to respond to a couple of points. One is, it is germane whether or not the date, the hearing date, and knowing the response date, that is germane both to the timing of when you would have moved to withdraw admissions, because moving to withdraw, it was of no moment. They're not germane to anything until the moment of the summary judgment hearing. So the fact of the bait and switch, and it truly was a bait and switch, the fact of the confusion regarding the summary judgment hearing refutes absolutely both oh, they didn't move to withdraw the admissions before the judgment, and the question of the Divine case of whether or not they should have raised the arbitration issue as a reason for not, for summary judgment not being rendered. Let me talk about the whether or not there was confusion or lack of clarity regarding the summary judgment hearing. It is just flat not true that the continuance order was based just on the pendency of the kind of oddball to begin with, post-trial summary judgment setting. That is just not so. Not even plaintiff's motion was based solely on the existence of the November 11th summary judgment hearing. Ms. Bressa read to you one sentence in her motion for continuance, but the very, very next provision said, and defendants have presented several letters to the court requesting certain kinds of relief be granted to them in lieu of a trial. So she invoked, her clients invoked, the pendency of the arbitration issue as a grounds for continuance, and then said, in an effort to spare the expense so that this matter may be resolved by summary judgment or otherwise, continue the trial so the court may take up the matters as it sees fit. So that's what the plaintiff's motion for continuance says. The defendant's motion for continuance says, continue this trial setting so it can go to arbitration, like they had been saying over and over and over again from the get-go. And then if you look at the continuance order itself is so just a reasonable person, an ordinary prudent person under same or similar circumstances. It's at tab 4, appendix number 4 of our opening brief. An ordinary, reasonable person would look at this order as moving everything, as putting the whole entire case off. It does three things. First, it resets the matter for trial months off from November to March. Second, it requires that the parties mediate by February 15th before a specific person at a specific address, including the zip code. And then third, it sets a pretrial conference for March the 1st, where presumably the parties would either say, we settled on February 15th mediation, or we're ready to go to trial, Your Honor. It is an absolutely reasonable, ordinary, prudent person looking at that order for trial continuance would have believed that the whole thing got put off. And what led to this order, in substantial part, was a judge, please deal with my pending arbitration issue.
Wonder what led opposing counsel to show up at that hearing that a reasonable and ordinary person would have thought was put off.
The same thing that led that opposing counsel to send case dispositive request for admission that served no purpose other than having a gotcha against pro se litigants. And again, it is absolutely not true that those requests for admissions were aimed only at matters that were in dispute. The request for admissions did things like directly address long-arm jurisdiction.
I asked you a question about, do you know if they called, would you have called to see if it was still on?
I would sure have called.
To see if the hearing was still on or not.
Absolutely. Because I'm a lawyer, because that's what I do for a living. But you know what? The Texas Supreme Court in the Marino case and the Wheeler case, they discussed the principle that I agree with wholeheartedly, that pro se litigants do not have an absolute free pass to avoid compliance with the rules of civil procedure and the local rules and the necessary administrative processes that courts have to be able to get through the grist. Courts are busy. They need to be able to move things along. They need to be able to manage their dockets. And pro se litigants do not have an absolute free pass. But nor do pro se litigants, nor should they be treated as second-class citizens. They should not suffer from impediments and requirements that lawyers who practice regularly in the court are not subject to, like we see in the record here on the setting of the summary judgment. And what the court said is, in the Marino case and in the Wheeler case, the state of mind is relevant, as it is here, where in order to be entitled to summary judgment based on those litigation dispositive request for admission, the plaintiff has the burden to prove callous disregard and flagrant bad faith.
Counsel, your time is up.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. And I respectfully submit that that the state of mind of my litigants, of my clients, does not support that finding. The summary judgment is infirm, and we request that you reverse and vacate the summary judgment, reverse, and remand for a consideration of the merits of the arbitration.
Thank you. Thank you both for excellent briefs, excellent arguments. Your case is submitted, and you are excused. And we will stand in recess for 10 minutes.